We are ready to go. We are professionals. Although, I don't know if you've seen the news. I was looking at the Hollywood Reporter's list of the 40 most influential people in podcasting in 2023. You remember that episode of The Simpsons where Homer and the B-Sharps are looking at Hot or Not magazine and finding out, are we hot or are we not?
Well, wait, so are we hot or not?
According to the Hollywood Reporter, we are not. We are not among the 40 most influential podcasters in 2013. We are not in the esteemed company of comedian and actor Jason Bateman, Conan O'Brien, or, of course, your friends, the Pod Save America boys, who I would wager represent something closer to the grassroots edge of this list, as do Joe Rogan and Ben Shapiro, who are on the list. But for the most part, the list, the list also includes Audible, which is not a person. It's a brand. It's owned by Amazon. Same with Higher Ground Audio and iHeart and NPR. They're also on there. I don't think NPR or, in fact, the New York Times also, they don't get to be on the list of the 40 most powerful people in podcasting. Those aren't people. I'm sorry. Conan O'Brien is at least a flesh and blood human.
Well, welcome back to Michael and Us. As always, I'm Luke Savage. With me,
I'm Will Sloan, and I'm all fired up about this. Let me tell you how the first paragraph of this article goes. It is the best of times and the worst of times for podcasting. In 2023, the industry put the brakes on a period of lavish spending and nine-digit mega deals, and, much as its streaming counterparts did last year, followed largesse with austerity. Facing challenges surrounding the advertising model, macroeconomic concerns, and post-pandemic slowdown, some of the biggest players, including Spotify, Vox Media, and NPR, announced mass layoffs. Many others, like SiriusXM and Amazon, cut their podcast budgets significantly. And yet, unlike in other struggling segments of the entertainment business, audiences are continuing to grow with no ceiling in sight. Well, I'm sure that you identify with most of that. I'm sure that is very reflective of your experience, Luke, in the industry. Certainly the audience growing with no end in sight. I think we can feel that a little.
You know what I like about the corporatization of podcasting, like these lavish budgets? You take podcasting, which is literally like the lowest cost, like no overhead. You need a microphone and like one to two people. And they figured out how to build a whole business model around like deals where you have to, you know, you pump in tens of millions of dollars to attract top talent, you know, like the former Duke and Duchess of Sussex. And then those people are too fucking lazy to even like record 12 episodes or whatever. And then it falters. And it's like, just invest a fraction of that into like actual programming and you'll do fine. God damn it.
You made the point a few weeks ago, and I feel like I maybe undervalued the point when you made it, but I'm really coming around to it. Now that I'm reading this Hollywood Reporter article, the point that what we're seeing in this article is something different than podcasting as we know it. It's a whole other, it's basically an outgrowth of the streaming industry more than it is, you know, I think what we're doing is more like an outgrowth of the blogging or perhaps the ham radio industry. It's something else.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. Like, if you're making something that calls itself a podcast and there are like seven figures involved in it, it's not podcasting, it's something else. It's just on-demand media. Podcasting has to be like, I don't know, it has to be the outgrowth of something democratic. It has to have at least some kind of, you know, at the outset, homegrown quality. And it has to attract at least some of its following, as it were, organically. Otherwise, it's just indistinguishable from like anything that a, you know, legacy media organization does.
This is something I don't think I quite understood when I would listen to, well, for example, Conan O'Brien's podcast. You listen to his podcast and you'll hear him doing ads for, I don't know, what Casper Mattresses or MeUndies or all those podcast businesses. And I would always hear that and think, well, why is why is he, surely this is a labor of love for him. Why is a naive little me?
Yeah, you think Conan O'Brien is just doing a podcast like we did in 2016, where it's like, oh, it'd be fun to like...
Yeah, he wants to talk to his celebrity friends. it's nice. Why does Conan O'Brien, who I think, didn't he get a $40 million severance package from NBC? Like, why is he advertising mattresses?
You know, our friend Henry Gilbert from the Talking Simpsons podcast, I saw him tweet something to the effect of, it's interesting that you don't see Chapo Trap House on this list, given that the model that they, I don't know if pioneered is the right word, but certainly helped popularize, the Patreon model, was such an inspiration for so many podcasts, basically created so many people's livelihoods. They're not the only ones to do it, but certainly they're like one of the most popular ones to do it. But then I sound naive even saying that, because that's not the point of this article. Like, the subheading of the article says, newcomers like Audie Cornish and Ben Shapiro join the list of on-air and off-air power players helping the medium overcome its growing pains. So, like, we're the growing pains. The democratization is the growing pains.
Is the growing pains. That's very interesting. I love the idea of Ben Shapiro is like, as a podcaster. I mean, the Daily Wire was going to offer Steven Crowder, whose YouTube show, by the way, like, I think he had about 50,000 subscribers on YouTube. I mean, this is a whole other conversation, but conservative media is literally just like a fucking welfare circuit funded by billionaires. Like, Steven Crowder, whose YouTube channel I don't think was that big by the standards of, you know, YouTube channels, they were going to give him, I think, a 40 or was it a $50 million contract for 4 years to move his show over to the Daily Wire. And Steven Crowder, being the fucking diva that he is, I mean, he's had some problems since, some other problems, but Steven Crowder was like, oh, that's not enough money. What you don't understand is I have to pay my staff out of that. That's not all for me. And it's like, oh, I'm fucking sorry. Your $50 million podcasting contract from the Daily Wire wasn't enough. The Daily Wire has enough money that they make like movies and shit. Yeah, again, not podcasting.
I guess I was being unfair when I said that we and the democratization are the growing pains. That's not quite accurate. The growing pains are spending... How much did they give the Duke and Duchess of Sussex?
Again, tens of millions of dollars, and they didn't...
That's the growing pains.
Yeah, right, and they didn't, like, they had to cancel the deal after they, like, didn't produce enough content. And I think they were so lazy that they didn't even do some of the interviews themselves. They had to, like, they hired somebody to do them after or something.
Let that be a lesson to all of you. You think this is easy? Well... Sometimes it is, but apparently for no less than the fourth or fifth in line to the throne, it wasn't that
these
easy.
These losers couldn't do it with like tens of millions of dollars and a whole retinue of people to order around, and they couldn't do what we do. I mean, you don't You don't see them sitting.
We're braver than the troops.
That's right. You don't see them sitting through the congressman. Which we will come back to in a minute. We went on quite an odyssey with this one. But I don't know, Will, I was kind of thinking we could start off nice and easy, maybe talk about what we've been watching. I've been in COVID quarantine, so, you know, I've had some time on my hands.
Well, let's start with you then. What are some of the things you've been watching?
I've been watching Twin Peaks, which I'd seen the first season once, just a few years ago. Don't think I was quite as familiar with David Lynch, though, when I saw it. And so I think I didn't quite have as much context for the eccentricities of that show, but I'm really, really enjoying it. I'd forgotten how engrossing the mystery is. And of course, the whole thing is really just a warm-up to Twin Peaks The Return, which, I mean, it's absurd that there's like 17 hours worth of David Lynch stuff, more than like the preceding 20 years of David Lynch stuff that's been out since, what, 2019 or something, and I haven't watched it. So we're going to rectify that soon. And hopefully you can start watching Twin Peaks, and then we can talk about it on mic for you, the listeners.
Yeah, I do intend to start watching it soon. Can you believe that I'm saying that? I do intend to start watching Twin Peaks soon. The reason why I haven't watched it yet is because my domestic live-in partner doesn't particularly care for David Lynch, doesn't object to him, just Lynch doesn't speak to her. And when it comes to TV shows, which are such a time commitment, it certainly helps to have the partnership of your domestic partner going forward. But I think this has been going on too long that I've seen the first season. I saw it long ago. but it's been going on too long that I haven't fully immersed myself in one of the key artworks of the last 50 years. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, it's so it's I'm really, gonna... really good. I gotta think, like, what a pioneering thing that was.
Well, I'll tell you a movie I watched the other day. I watched a movie called Erotic Nights of the Living Dead. See, this is how I've been spending my time.
You're like, oh, I don't have time to watch Twin Peaks. I'm too busy with Erotic Nights of the Living Dead.
Well, what I will say is Erotic Nights of the Living Dead, the Blu-ray had been sitting on my shelf for well over 2 years. Because when are you going to find time for it? All 111 minutes of it. Yeah, it's a, you know, it's a horror porno from Italy from the year 1980, directed by the great Joe D'Amato. A ship full of people go to an island, a Haitian island, you know? Some stuff goes on in this direction, in that direction. You can imagine some of the things. Mark Shannon stars in it. And folks, if you know who Mark Shannon is, you know. And then in the last act, you know, there's some gory stuff all the way through, but in the last act, it becomes a very sort of dreamy, hypnotic zombie movie. Incredibly slow paced. You feel all 111 minutes of it. But
you're really selling
Joe
me on
D'Amato,
it.
The thing about him, and if you're a cinephile, you know all about Joe D'Amato. You've seen Emmanuel in America. You've seen Beyond the Darkness. You've seen Anthropophagus. You've seen Zombie 5, Killing Birds.
Man, I thought I appreciated film until now.
Emmanuel and the Last Cannibals, that's another good one. There's something about him. He hasn't had a lot of defenders over the years, but I like him because there's a kind of like weird bad dream quality to his movies that no other filmmaker has quite provided. The way that they'll go from like gauzy, softcore, maybe even hardcore porn, and then just imperceptibly slip into grotesque zombie violence and cannibal stuff and really transgressive. Oh, in fact, he came up on the podcast a few weeks ago because Emmanuel in America was the movie that David Cronenberg stumbled on TV that inspired him to write Videodrome. This is the kind of filmmaker we're dealing with here, Joe D'Amato. So, I don't know, Erotic Nights of the Living Dead, by the end of it, I was kind of on its side. For the first 90 minutes, I was like, this is a really awful Italian zombie porno movie, but a certain dreamlike trance quality took over in that last 30 minutes that really spoke to me. I also watched a lovely film, more in the art house category, I would say, although I do think Erotic Nights of the Living Dead blurs the line at times, but saw a lovely movie called Beatrix, an Austrian film from 2021 that certainly calls to mind a movie like Chantal Ackerman's Jean Dielman. It's about a young woman who's living alone in this big country home that she probably doesn't own. She's probably just house-sitting there, or it's hard to tell exactly why she's there. Most of the movie unfolds in silence as it follows her, you know, doing these quotidian activities, cleaning and sort of keeping herself entertained and just puttering around. Every now and then people will come into the house and the movie observes her sort of strange relationships with them, her odd interactions, whether it's a friend, whether it's a potential lover, potential roommates that come through. And the movie, which tells you almost nothing, you know, in words, sort of communicates a lot through gesture and composition and through action. The lead actress, who I think this is her only film so far, her name is Ava Sommer. I understand she hails from the performance art world. And so much of her performance, you know, just kind of puttering around the house and, you know, it's communicated through small gestures. And you realize, like it's a full body performance that so much is communicated through action, but not so much through words. So a very rigorous art house movie that by the end I found very devastatingly moving.
I watched a mini series in its entirety that I enjoyed tremendously. And I'm surprised there hasn't been more buzz about this, really. Maybe there was and I missed it. I guess I was pretty busy when it was airing. But I watched the 6-part miniseries, We Own This City, which was co-written by David Simon of The Wire fame. This came out in 2022. It stars John Bernthal. Also has, you know, if you've seen The Wire, lots of actors you'll recognize. It's based on a book that is, I suppose, a true crime book about corruption within the Baltimore Police Department up to and during and after the murder of Freddie Gray. So it is, I suppose, in a sense, a topical show in that some of the actors are playing real people and it's based on real life events. But for me, it managed to avoid all of the pitfalls that I now associate with that type of TV. It has the narrative complexity of The Wire. It's told over 6 episodes and is an entirely non-linear narrative. You actually see key events happen right at the beginning in the first episode, and then much of the rest of the series is spent taking you through the events that led up to them. Bernthal gives an absolutely incredible performance as just like an absolute piece of shit cop. It's very like The Wire in sort of being about, you know, different facets of this story. But unlike The Wire, it's basically all about the police. The criminals are not the problem. Crime is not really even the problem in this show. It has such a jaundiced view of policing, and, you know, justifiably so, that it is almost entirely about that. I don't want to say too much about it because I really think, you know, if you're listening to this and you liked The Wire, you should absolutely watch this show. It is a proper kind of spiritual successor that manages to be a searing critique of police corruption and brutality while also just being incredibly good and engaging drama. I very much had the same experience that I had the first time I watched The Wire, where you sit through an hour of very dense, kind of layered, narratively complex TV, but instead of wanting to turn it off, you immediately want to put the next episode on. So a good use of my COVID quarantine, I think, to watch that. We Own This City. Thoroughly enjoyed.
Oh, yeah. Dancy and I have been watching a bit of Love Island just for background noise.
I've actually never seen it. In Britain, Love Island is like a phenomenon. Like, everybody talks about it. It is water cooler talk.
I've been watching, I believe, the American version, although it has a sassy British narrator. One of those particular kinds of British narrators who's like the dregs of society, you know, just making quips and jokes.
What happens on Love Island? Is it like a contest?
Kind of. I'm like fucking 4 episodes in and I don't fully understand the rules. It's like you get a bunch of just monstrous people. I shouldn't be that judgmental. Lost souls, let's put it that way. You got a bunch of lost souls in their little bikinis and their tiny little bathing suits and, you know, men and women. And you put them in this little compound on an island. And I think the goal is for them all to find some sort of a partner. But like, okay, to give you an example of how it goes, the first episode, they got all 4 of the women lined up. Then each of the men comes out, and if one of the women wants to offer themselves up, volunteer, to be like, okay, I'll go on a date with you, they can do that. But the man then gets to pick whoever he wants from the 4, including people who haven't volunteered. The show is full of like weird games and rituals like that. Little couples will start to form, but then new games will be introduced where somebody can poach somebody's girl or somebody's guy. And I realize that this is just like a monstrous show full of people seeking fame for its own sake, no matter the cost. But coming in a moment when there's been so much talk of, I don't know, the politics of consent, everything about this show is baffling to me. Also baffling is the fact that they're constantly taking part in these games that are like, you know, truth or dare. You know, like, I dare you to lick some whipped cream off somebody's arm or something like that. Or like, if somebody kisses somebody, that's like such a huge deal. And you're watching this being like, okay, like, aren't you adults? Kissing, you know, licking some whipped cream off somebody's arm. Like, what are we doing here? Like, why aren't you all just having sex immediately? That's what this is all about.
I think this show is probably not for me.
Several rungs below Vanderpump Rules and many rungs below The Bachelor. So I don't recommend it to you.
Well, Will, should we get into our rather special little movie that we watch for this episode? On this podcast, folks, we like to boldly go where no one has gone before. And this is truly a movie that, I mean, if any of you have heard of this movie, let alone seen it, I'll be very, very impressed. I want to start off with an aphorism that I'm fond of quoting. When we're young, we think we're going all the way to the mountaintop. Then, some way along the journey, most men look up at the summit and they realize they're never going to get there. Then they look down and they realize how far they've come. And then they stop and enjoy the view and realize it's as far as they're going to go. And in a way I can't really quite articulate, that is what it feels like to do this podcast in 2023. It always feels like, you know, we're on our way to the mountaintop and we seek out that perfect, you know, politics, what a concept movie, and we never quite find it. And for a while that frustrates me. But then usually when I'm an hour into an entirely mediocre movie like this one, It gets its talons in me. I stop and I enjoy the view. And I realize I'm never going to get to the mountaintop. But I have many years of more movies like this to look forward to. Anyway, that's some shit that the main character of this movie says about the mountaintop. This movie is a movie written and directed by a former United States congressman from New York's 3rd District named Robert Mrazek. Will and I, after watching The Ides of March, we decided to make it a double feature. We found ourselves having more fun than we expected with that one, and we thought, what's another politics movie? Well, we've been kicking around this one for a while, knowing nothing about it except what we saw in the trailer, knowing that it was directed by a former U.S. congressman, and we thought, that looks like some shit. Let's watch that.
The House will be in order.
Charlie, we have a problem. The pledge. Someone took a video of you with your feet up on the whip's desk while everyone else is standing and saluting the flag like the few and the proud.
Yeah, well, as one of the few and the proud, let me tell you, I am not going to recite a loyalty oath every morning just to prove that I love my country.
Why do you refuse to say the pledge?
Is it true you dissed the Pledge of Allegiance?
This isn't a joke. This isn't a game. This isn't about health care.
You have one of the lowest morality ratings of any congressman in the nation.
Maybe I should propose a law that all husbands and wives be required to recite their wedding vows every morning.
And the thing is, this movie is no worse than any other movie we've watched like this with a bigger budget. It's honestly, it's pretty earnest. It's got some heart. I was kind of hoping that it would be worse once we got some way into it. Like, I was hoping it was just going to be a total trash movie, and it's actually just a very earnest, independent movie with sort of MSNBC kind of politics. And in a few places, I even had to kind of marvel at, like, the basic competency of some of the shots. I mean, this is better than Clerks 3, if I can be so bold.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that. I mean, we discovered this movie one day a few weeks ago when we went on Tubi.com and searched the word politics, which sometimes happens.
Yes, one of the methods that we've developed 7 years into this venture, this program for all of you, is Googling politics movie. And actually, incidentally, I was able to watch this movie on YouTube, so you too can watch it. And the thumbnail for it, on the thumbnail, it said award-winning movie. And then the caption that accompanied it, it said free drama movie. So free drama movie, that's what we're dealing with, folks.
Do we have any evidence of the awards it's won? Hang on, I'm on its IMDb page. Okay, at the AARP Movies for Grownups Awards, which, by the way, I did watch a broadcast of once. It airs on TV.
What?
Actual celebrities come to it, folks. The AARP Movies for Grownups Awards.
Wait, it's called the Movies for Grownups Awards?
Yes, I swear to Christ. So in 2017, when the winner of Best Picture went to a movie called Loving, which beat out such films as Manchester by the Sea and Silence, the former congressman who wrote and co-directed this movie, Robert Mrazek, won the Breakthrough Achievement Award at the AARP Movies for Grownups Award. So there you have it. Keep an eye on former congressman. When did he serve?
From 1983 to 1993, New York's 3rd District.
Keep an eye out for this fresh-faced young filmmaker.
Yeah.
This breakthrough achievement.
Yeah, he's 77 years old, and he's
really?
He's actually a pretty successful. He's written various Civil War based fiction that's been pretty well received, I think. So he's had a kind of second act after serving in Congress. But I don't think that he's going to be winning. I think this is probably the highest award that he's going to win. Having said that, we absolutely sat down to this movie to make fun of it. And honestly, it is not that bad. It's just kind of a very earnest movie for old people.
I actually halfway through started to regret stumping for this one because, yeah, it is so earnest. This movie isn't hurting anybody. And when we were kind of looking into this movie, we watched a trailer for it that, I mean, the trailer was very badly edited, didn't look good. I was kind of taken aback by, I don't want to overstate the case, but the visual beauty of some of the scenes in this movie. Most of the movie takes place in a beautiful New England fishing village. And I got to say, Mr. Mrazek, he gets some really nice magic hour sunset shots, a lot of really nicely composed and lit scenes of Treat Williams by the shore.
Yeah, and apparently over the 20 many days of shooting, there were 13 days where they did not have like centralized electricity. So working under difficult conditions.
And look, if your grandpa, if your dad retired and then tried a hobby, you know, got into painting, you know, tried his hand at poetry, I'd say that's really nice. And I also say that about Robert Mrazek, who, again, a couple episodes ago, we talked about Clerks 3, made by a man who had made 15 movies. This one blows spots off Clerks 3 in every conceivable way. So what sort of politics movie does, you know, a boomer Dem congressman from the 80s make? Well, this movie begins, well, it has the opening credits where you see Vietnam.
Yeah, okay. The opening montage, the most boomer-ass thing ever. I was just waiting for, like, Fortunate Son to start playing. It was just...
If I never hear about the Vietnam War ever again, I'll be so happy.
What if we just never talked about JFK again? What if we make a pact, our generation to yours? No more talking about JFK. I don't know what you get out of it, but we definitely get something out of it.
So there's that opening montage. And in that montage, we catch our first glimpse of Treat Williams, who plays Charlie Winship, a 9-term member of the House of Representatives serving Maine. There's a photo of him seated during the Pledge of Allegiance. This becomes the scandal that is the inciting incident of this film. The Pledge of Allegiance is recited every day in Congress, and 9 terms into his tenure, Charlie Winship no longer feels the need to stand for it.
Now, I don't want to like blow my entire wad on this one early on, but I just think it's so weird that, you know, the narrative arc of this movie, this is the point of principle it hinges on. Like, as a non-American, I will cop to finding the Pledge of Allegiance really weird. Like, we had to sing O Canada, Will and I, growing up, and
every day at school, yeah.
Every single day, and, you know, I don't know, it's like an odd ritual, but I don't know, O Canada, by virtue of being a song, also by virtue of sort of being like people don't have the same reverence for it as they do for like the American flag or the Pledge of Allegiance. So that means that it's amenable, you know, like in schools they'll play novelty versions and things. I feel like the one I heard for many years was like the Bare Naked Ladies doing a rendition at the Sky Dome.
We had that at my school too. We had the Bare Naked Ladies cover. Yeah.
Yeah. So no one really takes it that seriously. So yeah, the Pledge of Allegiance is weird, and I'm absolutely, you know, I'm sympathetic to the idea that like having that as a sort of, you know, a ritual that like members of Congress have to do, what, every single day as they start the proceedings. Very, very weird.
I think what Congressman Mrazek is perhaps thinking of when he devised this script was the Barack Obama American flag lapel pin scandal of 2008. Do you remember? I mean, this was a very silly scandal from that time, but apparently at one point he was seen not wearing his American flag lapel pin. And
this is something where, like, it's only legible to you if you've consumed, like, 30,000 hours of Limbaugh first, at which point you're still mad about it like 15 years later.
So the congressman, the Treat Williams character, is tired and weary. He's exhausted by the corporate interests who are constantly at his door. He feels that being a congressman once meant something, but now exists solely to cater to the interests of big business. And this is where the villain of the piece, Laird Devereaux, played by Mr. Tan Man himself, George Hamilton, comes in.
Can I interject? Because, yeah, there's some stuff about big business in this movie, but I feel like his world weary monologue later in the film where he explains that, you know, Congress used to mean something. Like, his complaint is, he says, there was a time when Congress was important. It meant something just to be there. Now it's just all about delivering money for some bus station. So it kind of makes it sound like he's just bored by the job. We used to do grand things like, I don't know, drop napalm on Cambodia. And like now it's just all about, you know, I got there and I found out that serving my country is like, yeah, I don't know, allocating funds for a bus station. Like, he kind of just sounds bored to me.
Well, there's an interesting scene early on when the congressman is on his like public campaign bus, or it's not even really a campaign bus anymore. It's a sort of...
it's a mobile, like, constituency office or something.
Right, a constituency office that's sort of like, it's almost like a confessional where, like, constituents can drop by during office hours and give him a piece of their mind. And there's a montage where we see several constituents arguing with him or yelling at him about some of their pet causes.
I voted for you the first time you ran, and I think that you have become sadly out of touch.
My daughter teaches English at the high school, and she smuggled this filth out of the health class. The teaching children how to use tampons.
I need you to fix this or I am going to powder keg that mailbox. And the next time one of those little fecklatards puts a baseball bat on my mailbox, there's going to be C4 packed in it and I'm going to clean them up with a sponge. I've got the buckets and the windows are boarded.
He's tired after 9 terms in Congress of listening to all these sort of wacko fringe complaints. But what I kind of like about this movie, and genuinely I do kind of like it, is that the filmmaker himself seems hung up on certain kind of like fringe issues of his own. It's a movie that to some degree is attempting to take the pulse of the issues facing our politics in the year 2016, but it's also hung up on the filmmaker's own very specific and idiosyncratic view of free expression, as well as overfishing, which seems to be his chief hobby horse. And like, listen, I don't like overfishing either.
I'm in favor of like the exact right amount of fishing. That's where yeah, I stand.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not saying it's not a serious issue. And I'm just saying that I could imagine this former congressman showing up at the town hall for the congressman who replaced him and being the guy who was like, and another thing, how come you guys in Congress don't do anything about overfishing? Why do you know that if we don't get the ecosystem in balance, then it's, you know, the apocalypse will happen, et cetera, et cetera. Like it's, I think it's just funny that he included that montage of like the eccentric constituents. But I think he has a certain tendency of that in him as well.
It does seem like when he was in Congress, he worked on a lot of conservation issues. You know, I'm not in
good
a position to say whether, you know, signature Robert Mrazek legislative items like the National Film Preservation Act, that's not conservation, what am I saying? The Edwards Substitute Amendment, some kind of Civil War battlefield protection thing.
Wow, so hang on, wait a minute. He established the National Film Registry in the Library of Congress. That's crazy. I mean, this is, okay.
Well,
I mean,
that's conservation.
No matter, I mean, whatever you think of, you know, his own contributions to the seventh art, you can't deny the role he's played in film preservation. I mean, Jesus.
He was also associated with something called the Tongass Timber Reform Act. Mrazek's landmark conservation law revoked the artificially high timber cutting targets, protecting over 2 million acres of Tongass's old growth forest and watershed acreage, and mandated broad buffers for all salmon and resident fishing streams. So it's autobiographical in that sense. And, you know, he also served in the U.S. Navy. He was in Vietnam, received a training injury of some kind, and then later turned against the war. Oh, yeah. And to this day, he is the he was the founding chairman of the Alaska Wilderness League. He still serves as honorary chair with former President Jimmy Carter. So yeah,
I don't see too much to object to.
Nah,
here.
Whatever,
he seems like an all right guy.
Yeah, it was fine. He put a lot of that in the movie, is the point. So yeah, the whole movie is about overfishing in a small New England town. I want to return just though, cause I didn't finish my point earlier, to this, what you called his idiosyncratic view of freedom of speech, because yes, one of the kind of, rising actions of the film, one of the inciting incidents is that he refuses to give the Pledge of Allegiance. Everyone else is doing it. He's just sitting at his desk. He gets filmed doing this. And then later, when he's outside this mobile constituency office, he gets asked about it by a reporter. And he kind of mocks the Pledge of Allegiance. And he says, do you know where that came from? It was actually, he says, a national socialist came up with it. And you know what school children originally did when they said the Pledge of Allegiance? And then he does like the Nazi salute.
Can you give some insight about what he meant by national socialist in this sense? Is he referring to, you know, the Germanic kind of national socialism?
Well, so I think what he's referring to is that there was a guy by the name of Francis Bellamy who didn't write it. It was written by Captain George Thatcher Balch, who was a Union officer during the Civil War, who later wrote a book about, you know, how to teach patriotism in public schools or something. And then later in 1892, a guy called Francis Bellamy revised the verse as part of some tie-in for a celebration of Christopher Columbus. Francis Bellamy was a Christian socialist Baptist. So, I mean, unfair, I think. I don't know much about this guy, but he was associated with Christian socialism, and he was also an ardent secularist as well. So he did not believe in including the phrase under God in the pledge. It does seem like maybe there was a ritual associated with this before the Third Reich existed, where people would do, I guess it was called the Bellamy salute, and it was the salute later taken
the
up.
The Heil Hitler salute.
The Heil Hitler salute later taken up by the Nazis. But the thing is, the main character of this movie, Congressman Winship, just like decides to do a Nazi salute in front of the cameras and does this whole lecture about how, like, yeah, the Pledge of Allegiance was, you know, it's not what you think it is and blah, blah, blah. You know, he asked the reporter, oh, who do you think wrote it? And she was like, the Founding Fathers. And he's like, wrong.
Do you know who wrote the Pledge of Allegiance?
The Founding Fathers?
No. And it wasn't etched on the tablets Moses brought down from Mount Sinai either. The Pledge of Allegiance was written by a National Socialist by the name of Francis Bellamy, who believed that the government should take over the schools. He ordained that the pledge should be recited while all American school children stood and gave the so-called Bellamy salute. Have you ever seen the Bellamy salute?
I don't know, that it's bad and it was associated with this salute. And I don't know, it's just like a really weird point of principle to like be like, I'm going to do the Nazi salute and then I'm going to like pedantically explain to people that it's my right to do this or something and you shouldn't get mad about it. It's just like a very, very odd kind of contrived little incident to me.
First of all, a wag of the finger at Congressman Mrazek for his, I think, sloppy conflation of socialism with National Socialism.
Yeah, I think he's one of those Cold War liberals. You know, it's like there's a lot of lines in this movie where he's talking about how, you know, we weren't reciting the Pledge of Allegiance when we were in Vietnam holding back the communist hordes or something. And then later, yeah, he talks about the character this is, talks about how he volunteered for the war because I thought we were defending a fledgling liberal democracy, but that ended. And my faith left me. It seems like his disenchantment with the Vietnam War. I mean, this is the character, and I think it's probably fair to extrapolate Robert Mrazek speaking through his character. It seems like his, you know, disenchantment with the war did not really involve disenchantment with, you know, the American Empire or anything like that. It was just kind of like it was a more generic sort of, you know, wow, what are we fighting for kind of thing. Yeah, the sort of Cold War lib stuff definitely comes through in this movie.
But anyway, here, the villain of the film, the Koch brothers-like lobbyist played by George Hamilton, sees an opportunity. And Hamilton has been working in the background with the congressman's chief of staff, played by Ryan Merriman, playing a character named Jared Barnes. The chief of staff and the lobbyist have been working together to find an incident that can rally popular support against this incumbent congressman so that the chief of staff might be able to ascend to his chair, to have a shot at the big brass ring. This scandal is at first undetected by the congressman, who shortly after giving that interview where the Nazi salute was taken out of context, embarks on a journey to the remote island village of Catatonk, where shockwaves have been driven through the community by a dispute between the big fishers and the small fishers. That's basically what it is. You've got some kind of militia-type people that he meets with, militia liberals, basically, who are like, we don't bother anybody, nobody bothers us, and we were on a nice, clean town here where we're tolerant of everyone.
They're like benign New England people, but they're like also like, don't tread on me.
And Treat Williams says, well, that's all fine by me. He doesn't do a lot of politicking on this trip. He mostly putters around the village, visits the library, and it's at the library where he meets his love interest, Ray, played by Elizabeth Marvel.
Yeah, now Elizabeth Marvel is a pretty successful actor. I mean, she's been in Burn After Reading, True Grit. She was in Lincoln. She has like a recurring role as the Solicitor General. I'm forgetting the character's name on House of Cards. She's in the Fargo TV show. She has a recurring role on that. So yeah, pretty successful.
And by the way, Will's Gossip Corner. What if I told you that her husband, Bill Camp, memorably played the role of Vampiro in the recent Michael and us favorite film, Sound of Freedom? Just a family of working actors. And I can respect that. Just competent actors who come in and get the job done no matter what the job is. Now, Ray, the Elizabeth Marvel character, is at an earlier stage of her midlife crisis than the congressman is. She's divorced and has floated through a series of relationships, looking for something, looking for some kind of sustained connection. is there more to life than this, etc., etc. The two of them strike up an unlikely bond.
And there's this kind of weird scene when their courtship's beginning, and then some guy called Brad comes over. It's like this beautiful, idyllic, like, Maine sunset. This guy called Brad comes over, and she's like, oh, sorry, give me a sec. I just have to go argue with Brad. And then, you know, you hear her sort of off camera saying, like, Brad, it's over. I'm not interested or whatever. And then there's, like, this whole conversation where she's just like, yeah, you know, I wasn't really into Brad, but, you know, I stayed with him because the sex was extraordinary. It was amazing. Brad was such a good lover. I couldn't really tell where this fit in the film. I thought it was a little much.
I liked it. I think it was a much needed bit of texture in an otherwise fairly milquetoast film. Now, it was at this part of the movie when I started to realize what this movie was, which is a nice movie for old people. You know, old people could find this one on Tubi and just have a nice, relaxing time with it.
Yeah, they can find it under the label free drama film.
You got a couple of, you know, really, really nice, really competent actors acting very competently and nicely. And, you know, just one of those stories about middle-aged people having another shot at life, you know. And I think that's nice. There's room for movies like that. They're not for me, but there's room for movies like that.
So basically, he spends some time on the island, learns some lessons. He realizes that, you know, the simple life is more appealing than all those shenanigans in Washington.
Goddamn, who would have thought, you know?
There is kind of an interesting secondary plot where the staffer, played by Ryan Merriman, the staffer's name being Jared Barnes, he ends up, like, crashing in some guy's house who's, like, a painter or something. This was kind of interesting because this guy, whose name is Ben, asks if he can paint Jared, and then he says, sit on the bed. And it's pretty clear that Ben is actually gay, and I don't think that Jared ever really quite realizes this. They strike up a friendship, Ben paints Jared, and then at the end, as Jared's leaving, he's like, hey, I should, you know, come down to Washington sometime, see the National Gallery. And he says, yeah, you know, I will. Maybe I will when fishing season is over. Nothing else is really done with this. I'm not really sure what this B story serves.
Well, I think that chief of staff character is the one who has the most of a kind of moral arc throughout the film. You know, he begins the movie as this overly ambitious staffer willing to throw the Treat Williams congressman under the bus, and he ends it in a different place. And something about that meeting with that painter awakens something in him, awakens his fundamental humanity, which leads to the third act. So, while on the island, Congressman Treat Williams has been informed of the scandal that has happened. The scandal has spread quickly, stoked, it is implied, by the George Hamilton lobbyist character. Everyone from coast to coast is caught up in a Heil salute gate. All of Congress, seemingly all of Congress, has rallied around an expulsion motion around the congressman. So now, finally, after a pleasant stay on the island, the congressman has returned to the island to face his destiny. And this is where the movie, this is where the movie started to kind of become the movie that I wanted it to be.
Oh, hell yeah.
Treat Williams gives this speech, you know, much like The Great Dictator, one of those kinds of speeches.
Epic. Yeah, what makes us unique as Americans isn't a bumper sticker or a slogan. It's that no American ever has to take a pledge to any dictator.
And I think when Congressman Mrazek makes his next movie, I'd like to see him lean a little bit more into his eccentric side rather than making a nice romantic movie for old people. I'd like to hear more of his thoughts about free expression, because basically the contours of Treat Williams' speech are, you know, he comes out to this rowdy town hall full of people like calling for blood. They are braying. They are ready to frickin' kill this man. They are so offended by his conflation of the Nazis with the Pledge of Allegiance. And so he delivers this speech about how, you know, America was the first nation founded upon an ideal.
What makes us unique as Americans isn't a bumper sticker or a patriotic song, the flag, or even the Pledge of Allegiance.
What makes us different is that no American is required to take a pledge of allegiance to a king or a dictator or even to a flag. We are a free people.
Now, the American flag is a symbol of that freedom, an important and wonderful symbol.
In my life, I've seen it flying in a lot of places around the world. In 1970, I saw it flying above a hill called Khe Sanh in the Quang Tri province of Vietnam. Seeing it flying there above us and later on in many other places around the world has never ceased to fill me with enormous pride. But to me, that pride comes from what the flag represents, what it symbolizes, not just the flag itself. As Americans, we are different because we were the first nation in the world to be founded on an idea. The idea that each of us has value as an individual. And that we are free to express ourselves in any way we choose. Or not to express ourselves at all. In 1950, Margaret Chase Smith, a Republican senator from right here in Maine, chose to take on a fellow senator who had questioned her patriotism. His name was Joseph McCarthy. And this is what she said. Those who shout the loudest about Americanism are all too frequently those who ignore some of the basic principles of Americanism.
That each of us was an individual, and that we all have the right to express or not express ourselves however we want. Now, look, I worship the Pledge of Allegiance. I care so much about the Pledge of Allegiance that I'm actually sort of doing a long con to, like, not say it, to therefore prove a point about how much it matters. And nobody has the right to say whether or not saying the Pledge of Allegiance is something I should do, because the Pledge of Allegiance guarantees that I don't have to say it. Mic drop. And that's why America is so great, that I don't have to say the Pledge of Allegiance, because it's guaranteed to me in it. Is that a fair enough summation of what he says?
Yeah, I think so. It's pretty pedantic, but then the whole thing is packaged with this, you know, epic sort of boomer American exceptionalism speech, which is what, you're right, it is indeed what I was hoping this movie would serve up. And let's just say that Mr. Mrazek saved the best for last.
And so what happens with this audience that was braying for his blood? Well, in just a few short minutes, they're won over. The overnight polls are in. Congressman, it seems you have a 200% approval rating somehow.
It's so funny. It cuts to his, like, his office the next day with his staff. And yeah, it's like basically like, extra, extra, Congressman exonerates self with epic speech.
Yeah, it seems like his reelection is assured. George Hamilton is quaking in his boots. How are we going to get this guy out now? But you know what? Trait Williams has seen a vision of a better life. He's been to a beautiful, idyllic fishing village. He's had a pleasant night with the wily divorcee, and he's decided that he wants to go back. And the film ends with him casting politics aside and returning to the remote island town.
Yeah, that's pretty much the movie. You know, as we've said from the outset, not as bad as we were kind of hoping.
Hoping, yeah.
I do wish they'd done a little more with the whole sort of like militia shooting war plot. It is a little weird that this fishing village is like armed to the teeth. And there is a scene where they wake up in the night and like one of the boats, this beloved local vessel called the Sea Hag, has been set alight by, you know, a neighboring clan. And I was hoping it would go a little more Mad Max, I have to say.
Well, after his triumphant showing at the AARP Movies for Grown-Ups Awards, perhaps Congressman Mrazek will follow up with a sequel a little more in that direction.
Climb up this tree, sit next to me on a trusty bench. Won't you hold my hand? Look at the view.
You know, it's funny, we look up this movie on YouTube and of course it's just there for free, and it's an interesting lesson in like just how many movies there are in the world and how little most of them like matter. how little value most of them have. Like truly, of all the movies that have been ever been made, probably about 1% of them accrue any sort of like residual like money. And then the rest of them are just like, yeah, put it up on YouTube for free. You know, who knows?
Well, this has on YouTube almost, over a quarter of a million views. And the comments are really effusive. People, an excellent and soul-stirring story. If you're an American, which I am, we need more government officials with that kind of integrity. Thomas Paine, founding father and revolutionist, said... I love he's a revolutionist, not a revolutionary. It's like a chemist.
There's a big difference there, Luke. Yeah. It's really important.
The famous revolutionist said, the duty of a patriot is to protect his country from its government. Give that some thought. Sigh.
God damn.
Great movie. Enjoyed watching it. Yes, great speech. Heart touching. I love this movie. I saw Charlie's War, about what he went through during his policies for our veterans. glad to see what he went through to get him to that point. Great congressman in the long end. We need more politicians like him. Now, so people like this. And yeah, a whole bunch of other stuff comes up. Sugar Mountain, free full movie, Jason Momoa. That has 2.5 million views. And it has, I guess, Jason Momoa, Carrie Elways. I've never heard of it. They have whole playlists here. Free Western movies, free drama movies, free Asylum movies. Interesting.
Asylum is the company that makes the Mockbusters. That's what they're called. Like they made.
Oh, man. Yeah, there's one here.
On
top,
a train.
Top Gunner. And it's like a Top Gun parody.
Not a parody, a ripoff. They also did Transmorphers. when the Robert Downey Jr. Sherlock Holmes movie came out, they had their own Sherlock Holmes because, of course, Sherlock's in the public domain. They had a War of the Worlds when Steven Spielberg's War of the Worlds came out. The Asylum. I love everything about them except their movies. Yeah, I love those comments you were reading about this movie. I've had cause to say this a few times of late, but I'm reminded of what Peter Bogdanovich used to say about the TV movies he directed in the 90s. He said, nobody watched them except millions of people. And that's definitely the case with this.